as frequently there aren't any. But since yesterday we did Shor's algorithm, I'm sure people have generated some questions on that by now. Right? No, still no questions. Everyone understands Shor's algorithm. Go over it again? Okay. So big picture, remember, is we have two registers, right? One of them, so the point of Shor's algorithm is to compute the period of some function. And of course, the main use, as I said, is in factoring. But really, you can use it in a variety of other ways. So the way it works is you have some register which is going to take A. And we start by putting that in a superposition of all possible values of A using the Hadamard transform. And you have a second register, which, well, I guess they both really start at 0. Second register, which is going to hold the value of the function. And so here we do some subroutine that computes the function, right? Which in the case of factoring was x to the a mod n. And then this register we don't really use again, but it's convenient to measure it. And what that does is it collapses this first register, the measurement collapses this first register onto a superposition of different values of A that have the same value of the function. Okay, so that kind of brings out the periodicity in a more obvious way. And then we do the Fourier transform. And then measure. And in the case where it's exactly periodic, over, you know, as a kind of factor of 2 to the n, then this will give us some multiple of the 1 over the period. And we can figure out what that is after maybe a couple of tries. If it's not exactly periodic, then it'll give us something that's close to 1 over the period. And we have to do some, you know, approximation using the continued fractions to figure out exactly what the period is. Okay. So then, of course, we talked about some more details about how you implement this part in the case of factoring, x to the modular exponentiation, and how we do the Fourier transform, that all the way down to the level of individual gates. Okay? So that's the big picture again, but yeah. Right. So that old experiment where they factored 15 in NMR, actually they didn't do this whole thing. They didn't have enough qubits. Basically, what they did was the Fourier transform. Okay, and the rest of it they used some tricks that were kind of specific to the number 15, to find that it was 5 times 3. So one kind of minor note is that because the whole point of Shor's algorithm is to find some number y, where y squared is 1 mod n, this algorithm doesn't actually work. Shor's algorithm, you don't actually use it for even numbers. Okay. Now, of course, an even number is going to be 2 times something. And it's just easy to divide by 2 until it's no longer an even number. So if you want to factor an even number, it's not really any harder. But that means that the smallest number, which you can use it on, has to be a product of 2 distinct primes. So 6 is no good because it's even, right? So the smallest number that is a product of 2 distinct primes is, in fact, 15, 3 times 5. So that's why they were factoring 15. Other questions? Okay. So then let's move on to a new algorithm. This one is Grover's algorithm. And so this problem is for, so the problem that we're trying to solve is sometimes called database search . A more descriptive name might be unstructured search. So the idea here is you have some unsorted database. Well, the idea of database search is you have some unsorted database and you want to find something in it. Okay? More generally, it doesn't really have to be a literal database. It can be some function that you're computing, and you want to find certain values that the function. So if, I'll give a couple of examples of that in a second. And so in particular, we abstract this as an oracle, which again is going to take n bits to 1 bit. And the oracle has some values of x for which it gives 0, and some values for which it gives 1. And in particular, we want to find whether this is always 0, or whether it's not always 0. So for instance, there might be one value for which it's 1. Okay. And more generally, we actually don't really so much care about this decision, whether it's all 0 or has 1 in it. We want to actually find this marked element. Okay, so as a unstructured database search, it's maybe easy to understand how this works, or what this means, right? You have a big list of names, and it's not alphabetized, and you want to find if one particular name is on that list. Okay, and in particular, you might want to find where on the list it is. So an example that people used to give, but maybe it's becoming less culturally resonant, is you have a phone book, okay, and so that's sorted alphabetically by name, but you have a particular phone number. You want to know what name goes with the phone number that you have, okay? And you know, classically, the way to do that is to look through the whole list until you find the phone number. But phone book's very big, that's hard to do. And it turns out a quantum algorithm can do it a bit faster. But this idea of focusing on a kind of a physical database, which is a long list of numbers, is in a lot of cases a bit confusing because, for a couple of reasons. Partly because in order to do this as a quantum algorithm, you have to create a quantum database, and it's a little hard to understand exactly what that means and how that works. I think it does make sense, but that's something that a lot of people have trouble with. But you don't really need to do that. It can be that this oracle O of X is, again, an abstraction of some kind of function where it's easy to compute it one way, but it's hard to compute it the other way. So it's easy to compute it forward. Given X, it's easy to compute O of X. But then going backwards, finding a specific value of X that gives a particular output for that function, that's hard. Okay? So So in general, this O of X is like the verifier for some problem in NP. So for instance, if we have 3SAT, right, that's a NP-complete problem, in fact, then given some truth assignment, and And I'm going to write it just as a bit string, but that's a bit string is assigning a bit to each of the variables. Okay? The first bit is the first variable, and the second bit is the second variable, and so on, with 0 false, 1 is true. And our O of x then could be the evaluation of the formula on assignment x. Okay? And then solving Grover's problem in this case corresponds to finding a valid witness x for this three-set instance. Right? Because when O of x equals 1, that means that this formula evaluates to true. Okay? So solving Grover's problem is equivalent to solving this NP-complete problem. Okay? So another example would be factoring. So you could approach factoring this way as well. You'd say, for instance, you might say, so x is some number, which is a potential factor of n. And then O of x is 1 if p divides n, and 0 if p does not divide n. Okay? And so then you want to do a search to find the values of x that give us 1. In other words, the factors of n. So n is the number that you want to factor. Okay, so these are two examples. And the point is that, well, in this case, the Oracle is a black box. And when you think of it as a database, it's, you know, it's hard to think of it anything other than, you know, a big, big list of things. These are examples of how you can have some explicit function that calculates O of x, where it's still not easy, given these functions, to find the marked elements. Okay. So in the case of factoring, we know how to do it using Schur's algorithm, but classically it still seems to be something that's pretty hard. In the case of three-set, we don't know how to do it at all. And so the idea of Grover's algorithm, I mean, is to study a problem that's indeed supposed to be kind of an abstraction of the idea of an NP-complete problem. It takes the one thing you really know about it, that it has this verifier function, and it throws away everything else. Okay, and so if there were a quick solution to Grover's algorithm that worked in polynomial time in little n here, we then have a good solution to quantum solution to NP complete problems. Okay, but as it turns out, Grover's algorithm can't be solved that fast. So actually, the way I wrote this here was as n bits. But usually what's done for Grover's algorithm is we just kind of treat it as one big lump. And it doesn't even have to be a power of 2. We're going to just say, I don't know if you can see that. So this is a different n than this one. But big N here. So the input here is just some number from 1 to big N. Okay, and the output is, again, a single bit. And we want to find the marked element within this range, 1 to big N. Okay? Right. And so as I said, if you try any classical algorithm, it takes a time O of big N. Okay, and I should say, actually, because it's an Oracle problem, we don't want to calculate in terms of time. We want to calculated in terms of queries. So it takes O of big N queries to the oracle. And you can actually prove that, because this is an oracle problem. That there's a limit to just how fast you can get information out of this oracle. And this is it. And it's not incredibly hard to prove this, but you can intuitively understand it very quickly. You imagine cases, different oracles that have exactly one marked element in different locations. Okay? And as you can't really do anything but ask different inputs to this oracle. And, you know, there's n minus 1 zeros and only 1 1. Right? So kind of whatever sequence of things you ask, it's unlikely that you'll happen upon the marked element until you've tried a large fraction of all possible inputs. Okay? And that's where this O of n comes from. Okay, it's probably on average it's about n over 2. Okay? Okay, so now let's do the quantum algorithm. I guess I can do it over here. So let's focus first on the case where there's only one solution. So in other words, the marked element is unique. Okay, so in that case, the marked element is special, x0. And so I'm going to call that S for no particular reason. But all the other values are basically equivalent, right? Because there's no structure here. It doesn't matter, you know, if we rearrange all of the other ones and call them different things. We can't take advantage of that anyway. So our algorithm is actually going to treat them completely symmetrically, all of the unmarked elements. Of course, it doesn't know a priori which are the marked elements and which are the unmarked elements. So this thing that I'm writing down here is just for the analysis. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to define a state T, which is the superposition over all of the unmarked elements. Okay? And our algorithm is only going to talk about S and T. Okay, again, it won't do that explicitly, but all the things it does will be on different superpositions of S and T. In other words, it's focusing just on a two-dimensional Hilbert space. It's a two-dimensional Hilbert space spanned by these two vectors. Okay? So what can we do in this Hilbert space? Remember, we don't know explicitly what S and T are. Right? All we know how to do is call the oracle. So what happens if we call the oracle? So suppose we have psi, which is some superposition of S and T. And we apply the oracle. So I'm going to call this operation minus 1 to the O. Okay. So if we apply minus 1 to the O to psi, well, x0 is marked. Okay. So I guess the way I've been phrasing oracles mostly, you would have an ancilla, you'd have to attach it. It would get the value of the oracle added to it. But you remember on Tuesday, one of the tutorial problems was this phase kickback trick, where you can put the oracle in a phase, right, plus 1, minus 1, using only just one oracle call. Okay, so that's what I'm going to do here, just to really what we want to do is this phase. The question of whether it takes two oracle calls or one oracle call depends on the details of how you do it. But you know, since I'm only interested in the phase, we might as well just do it with one oracle call. Okay, and so what does it do? Well, it's going to take the marked element to minus 1 times itself, because the value of the oracle is 1, and it'll take the unmarked elements to plus 1 times themselves. And so s is then going to go to minus s, and t is going to go to plus t. Okay? So if we draw this, it's because it's a two-dimensional Hilbert space, that's very convenient because it means I can actually draw it. So if we start with some state psi up here, well, we get the s component becomes negative. So what we do is we go down to this state down here, which is the reflection over t. Okay? So that's one thing we can do. Now, if that's all we do, that's kind of not enough to do anything interesting, right? Because we do it again, we get back to where we started. We could do it and do it again, get back to where we started. That's not going to take us anywhere. So we need another operation. What we'd like to do is somehow move the state psi towards s. Okay? And by combining two different operations, we'll be able to do that. So what else can we do? Well, one thing we can do is we can make a state in the subspace. In particular, we can make the state u, which is s plus t, or in other words, the sum over all values of x. Right? And we can make this because it's superposition over everything just by doing the Hadamard on a bunch of zeros. Right? We've done that before. Okay? Okay, so that at least can get us started in the algorithm. But again, it's not quite enough to do anything because we just create this state. We could do a bunch of reflections and not really change anything. And then we could create another state, but that's not going to help us. So we need another reflection, and that's going to be the reflection over u. Okay, so how do we do that? Well, so to make u, we take a whole bunch of zeros and we do the Hadamard on them. And one thing we can do to all these zeros is we can do a phase shift on them too. Okay, we can take in particular, we have an operation which will take, So it'll take, let's define the operation minus 1 to the all 0 as something that takes the all 0 state to minus all 0, and it takes any other basis state to itself. Okay, so this is like the same reflection as the oracle does, except it's doing it over just a standard state that has nothing to do with the oracle of all zeros. Okay, and so what we can do to do the reflection over u so I'll call that minus 1 to the u. Well, that's going to be first, we do the Hadamard transform. Remember, the Hadamard transform is its own inverse. So we do the Hadamard transform, which will take u to all zeros. And then we do minus 1 to all zeros. And then we do the Hadamard transform again to map it back to u. Okay? And so you see, if we start with u, we'll get a phase of minus 1. Sorry. Right. Okay. So this is actually a reflection over things orthogonal to u. But that doesn't really matter, right? That's kind of the same as a reflection over u to a global phase. And so if we start with u, we'll get back u. No, wait. We'll get minus u. And if we start with u perp, then we'll get plus u perp. Okay? But then this up to a global phase is equivalent to the operation which takes u to u and u perp to minus u perp, which is the way I'm going to want to think about this operation. Right, the difference between these two has no physical significance. Are we okay so far? I know this is here. That help? Okay. So are there any questions on these reflections? Okay, so in that case, let me define an operation g, which is just minus 1 to the o followed by minus 1 to the u. Okay? We'll reflect over t, and then we'll reflect over u. And let's draw another one of these pictures that takes both of these things into account. Okay. So, first of all, we have u here. We have to add to the picture. And we start with some state psi, which is out here. Okay? The first thing we do is we reflect psi over t. So psi goes down here. And let's see, how did I count these angles? Okay. So let's say this angle here between u and t is theta. And this angle between psi and t is phi. Okay? Well, then psi is, this is minus 1 to the o psi. So minus 1 to the o psi is reflection over phi, so it also has an angle phi here. Okay? And then the next thing we do is reflect this thing over u. So we go up here somewhere, and this is going to be g psi. And so this angle here, right, is phi plus theta. Right? So the angle between u and g psi should be phi plus theta. And so what that means is that the angle between g psi and t is going to be phi plus theta plus theta. So this overall angle that we get here is phi plus 2 theta. Okay? So psi started with an angle phi from t, and it moved to an angle phi plus 2 theta from t. So it's getting further from t and closer to s, which is what we wanted. Okay? And this was for an arbitrary psi in this two-dimensional subspace. You might have to be a little careful if psi is between u and t, but you don't. So it really is for an arbitrary psi. I mean, you get the same answer. It's really for an arbitrary psi in this two-dimensional subspace. So what happens is we can start with just anything in this two-dimensional subspace. In particular, we can start with u. And then we do this g operation. We move closer to s. We do it again. We rotate further and further and further. Okay? So in particular, that's Grover's algorithm. So step one, create the state u. Step two, repeat g a number of times. And how many times do we want? Well, we started with an angle theta. We started with u. We started with the angle theta between u and t. And every time we do it, we get another 2 theta. Right? So what we want, so in particular, to get this full pi over 2 rotation, we want a number of times that's, well, OK. So maybe I should be a little more careful here. So in particular, we start with phi 0 that's equal to theta. And then after k iterations, we have some phi k, which is equal to 2k plus 1 theta, right? Because every time we do this g, we're adding 2 theta to this angle. In particular, we have a state psi k, which is equal to cos phi k t plus sine phi k s. Okay? So what we want is the number of times should be such that 2k plus 1 theta is pretty close to pi over 2. OK? And then I guess step 3, as always, is going to be measure. So then when we measure this register, well, we'll find s. And that will give us the marked element, x0. So are there any questions? Yeah?
I don't see how this operation here would take
the reflection
u
over here
into negative u. Yeah, I think it's making u.
Right. So the point is we do the Hadamard transform. So it takes u to all zeros. And then this operation takes 0 to minus 0. And then this operation takes all zeros back to u. Okay. So overall, if we started with u, we'll go to minus u. And if we started with something that's perpendicular to u, well, then this Hadamard transform has to take it something that's perpendicular to all zeros. And so this thing will take it to itself. And then this will take it back to something that's perpendicular to u. In fact, the same thing that it started as. OK? Right. And that's a reflection over u, just the same way that this thing was a reflection over t. Then you're OK with this. Oh, you're not OK with this. OK. So let's go through that again. There's now a lot of lines on this drawing. But so we start with psi. First thing we do is we reflect it over t. Okay? So reflecting it over t is because we're taking s to minus s, the s component to the minus s, and t is staying the same. So that's reflection over t. And so if we start with an angle phi between psi and t, then this reflection has an angle also phi in the other direction between phi and t. Okay. And the next thing we want to do is reflect over u. So u has an angle theta up from t. And this state has an angle phi down from t. Okay. So the total angle between this state and u is phi plus theta. This is what I drew here. Okay. So when we reflect over u, we should get something that's phi plus theta beyond u up here. OK? And then I just wanted to calculate how far this final state, g psi, is from t. Because that was what we started, that was our original reference for psi. And let's see, so we have an angle 5 plus theta from u, and u is theta from t. The total angle is just the sum, 5 plus 2 theta. Okay? Yeah. Right. So, okay, so I'm not quite done yet. But the what you'll find is that the value of k you need to make this true is about square root of n. Okay? So how do we see that? Why don't I calculate that? So in particular, we need to figure out what theta is. So so theta is supposed to be the angle between u and t. Okay. Now u, remember, is the sum over everything. T is the sum over unmarked elements. So the problem is I've written them in an unnormalized way. So let's normalize them. So and then cos theta will be the inner product between the normalized versions of u and t. So what's the normalized version of u? Well, u has n terms, because it's the sum over everything. So the normalization should be 1 over square root of n. And t has n minus 1 terms, because there's one marked element, and it's the sum over everything else. So the normalization is 1 over square root of n minus 1. And then, so we have this out front. And then let's figure out the inner product between u and t. Well, u is the sum over everything. T is the sum over everything but x0. And of course, these are basis states. They're all orthogonal to each other. So what happens is we get 1 for each term that appears, each basis state that appears in both of these. In other words, we get n minus 1. Because the x0 appears only in u, and everything else appears in both. So that's square root of n minus 1 over n. And then, of course, sine theta is going to be square root of 1 over n. So sine squared theta plus cosine squared theta. Cosine squared theta is 1. Okay? And in the case where n is large, which is the usual case, then this is very small, and theta is about equal to sine theta, which is 1 over square root of n. Okay? And since theta is 1 over square root of n, that means that we need a number of iterations equal to roughly pi over 4 times square root of n. Okay? Yeah?
So does this still work when there are multiple elements?
I'll get to that in a minute. So something very similar works. But we have to modify the analysis slightly and the algorithm slightly. But first I want to see if there's questions on this single marked element case. Okay, so there's a couple of things that I want to point out. So one of them is that most of the time, pi over 4 times the square root of n is not going to be an integer. In fact, I don't think it can ever be an integer because, you know, pi is a transcendental. What that means is that we can only do an integer number of iterations, obviously. So usually what's going to happen is that we don't get exactly to S. Instead, we just get to some state that's pretty close to S. Okay? And so that when we measure, there's a big probability that we'll get the marked element x0, but there's a small chance we'll get something else. And when we get something else, really what we're getting is a uniform superposition of everything else. So we're getting, it could be anything. It could be totally random if we don't get x0. Okay, so when we run Grover's algorithm, at the end of it, we should really plug our answer back into the oracle one more time to check whether it really is correct. Okay, and if it turns out to be correct, then we're fine, we're done. And if it turns out that it's not a marked element that we got, then we should do Grover's algorithm again. And because you can get very close to S, you don't have to do this very many times before you're very, very likely to get x0. But, you know, that's something you should do. It turns out in the case where there's one marked element, you actually know kind of exactly what all the exact behavior of the algorithm should be. And it turns out you can jigger the phases a little bit. You need, you know, some irrational phases. Instead of doing, full rotations here, you do some other phase instead of minus one. And you can make it turn out to get exactly x0. But of course, that involves, you know, very weird phases. And in practice, you're probably not going to do that. But in principle, you can make it exact, always. So the other thing, which is kind of much more interesting and important, is that if you run this algorithm for too many iterations, this is the state you get after k iterations. And you'll notice if phi k goes past pi over 2, the probability of the marked element s starts to decrease again. Right? So if you run this for too long, your search gets worse. Okay? Now, of course, if you run it for long enough, it'll start to get better again. And then worse again, and then better again, and then worse again. Okay, so that's just something to bear in mind, right? That this is not run it at least this many times. It's run it exactly this many times, you know, up to maybe a small difference. It doesn't matter so much.
So you require knowledge of theta.
Right. And in this case, we know theta because we know there's one marked element. Okay. And that's what lets us do this exact calculation of theta as inverse sine of 1 over square root of n.
But if you have more than one element, then?
If you have more than one marked element, okay. So.
You don't know how many elements you have, basically
can't do this. Well, we'll get to that. Hopefully. We have only a little bit of time. But I'll say it. I'll definitely say it. Okay. But are there questions on the more questions on the single element case? OK, so let's move on then to the case where we have t marked elements, but t is known. OK, so in this case, we can do basically the same analysis and basically the same algorithm. We, instead of writing s as the marked element, now there's more than one marked element. And we're going to treat all of them the same because, you know, there's no way for our algorithm really to tell them apart. So S is going to be the sum over marked x0. So it can now be a superposition of T different things. And T, of course, in other words, so marked x0 are x0 such that O of x0 equals 1. T is going to be the sum over unmarked x. And U is still the sum over everything. And U is still S plus T. OK? And this part of the analysis stays the same. We can still reflect over t by applying the oracle. We still reflect over u using the same subroutine. And when we do this Grover iteration, minus 1 to the u, minus 1 to the o, we still do the same thing. The only thing that's different is this angle theta has changed. Okay? So so what is the new theta? Well, we can calculate it the same way. So now we have to be normalize t differently. So u still has a 1 over square root of n. T, now there's t marked elements. So there's n minus t unmarked elements. So t is a superposition of n minus t things. And then the inner product of u and t is going to be n minus t. So the answer here is square root of n minus t minus n. And sine theta is square root of t over n. Okay? And again, when t is much less than n, that means that theta is about sine theta. And we find that theta is about square root of t over n. And so that means that we need the number of iterations to be not pi over 4 square root of n, but pi over 4 square root of n over t. So more marked elements makes it easier, which makes sense, right? There's more things to find. What's maybe interesting in the classical case, if you have t marked elements, it speeds it up by a factor of about t, right? Instead of order n tries, you need order n over t. In the quantum case, you need it only speeds it up by square root of t. So you need the square root of n over t. Okay. So it's actually maybe worth giving an aside of kind of conceptually why you get a square root speed up here, which is, so in the classical case, you're just kind of trying things at random. And so every time you try something, you have a probability 1 over n. In the case where there's unique marked element, probably 1 over n that you find the marked element. Okay? And as you do it multiple times, if you make sure that you try different things, then the probabilities will add up. Okay? And you need the probabilities to add up so that they're order 1 in order to have a good chance of finding the marked element. And you need to do that n times, obviously, order n times, before those probabilities will add up to something reasonable. So in the quantum case, we're doing it in superposition. We're doing our queries in superposition. And so instead of having, if we just measure it right away, we'd still have probability 1 over n of getting the marked element. But that means that in the quantum state, we actually had an amplitude of 1 over square root of n. And so Grover's algorithm basically gives us a way of adding up the amplitudes between different queries. And the amplitudes can add up after only square root of n tries, because they were only 1 over square root of, they were 1 over square root of n in size. Okay? So that maybe kind of gives you some understanding of why it's exactly a square root speed up versus the classical. Right. That's right. So this is still an exponential algorithm. When you had the input was on n bits, then you have 2 to the n possible queries, but square root of 2 to the n is still 2 to the n over 2. So that's still exponential. So this is only good for things where you know it's going to take a long time, and you just want it to take a slightly less long time. It's still going to be long. Okay. There are some problems where people do very, very large searches, and Grover's algorithm can help speed those up. You'll see actually on the homework some examples of how you can apply Grover's algorithm. I guess one is maybe an example you can immediately appreciate the value. The other one is a little more esoteric and it's related to cryptography, but nevertheless. Okay? So everyone happy with this so far? Okay. So in that case, let's move on to the case where we don't know how many marked elements we have. So when we don't know how many marked elements we have, there's two strategies. Okay, one of them, which actually works reasonably well, is we can try running it for different amounts of time. And you know, if you run it for roughly the right amount of time, then the probability of getting a marked element is pretty good. Okay, and once you find the marked element, you can check that, and so you're then you're done. And so by picking the right kind of different amounts of time to run it for, you can actually make that strategy work. But there's another one, which is very nice. And this one lets us actually approximately count how many marked elements we have. So, suppose we run Grover's algorithm for different amounts of time. Let's plot the amplitude that we get of the marked element versus the number of iterations. Well, we start out with some very small thing. It's actually not 0, it's 1 over square root of n. Right? And then it goes up. And it goes up basically to 1. And so that happens after a time that's given by that, right? It's pi over 4 square root of n over t. But then it starts to go down again. And it goes down, it goes down, it goes down, it goes down, all the way to minus 1, which is actually a good thing because we can, that's, the probability would be 1. And then it goes up again and down again and up again and down again and so on. Okay? And the time between the successive peaks here is going to be pi times the square root of n over t. Right? It's, if you look at this, it's 2k plus 1 theta is equal to 2 pi. Theta is square root of n over t. So k is equal to 2 pi over 2 is pi over theta. Okay? So what we have is the amplitude is periodic with period pi square root of n over t. Okay? So in other words, if we can figure out the amplitude, sorry, the period of this amplitude function as a function of number of iterations, then we can figure out t because we know n. Okay? So how can we figure out the period? Can anyone think of a way? Fourier transform. Indeed, Shor's algorithm already tells us how to figure out the period, right? Take the Fourier transform. So what we need to do is we need to somehow put this period in a superposition. So it's we want to calculate the Fourier transform with the amplitude. So in particular, what we can do is we can do a little algorithm that looks like this. So the first thing we're going to do, this is actually a bunch of qubits. And this is going to tell us the number of iterations. Okay, and so we start with all zeros here. And we put them in a superposition. So we run, obviously there's a kind of an upper limit to the number of iterations we're willing to do. And that upper limit is going to say how precise we can calculate this period. Then based on the number of iterations here, we do Grover's algorithm that many times on this second register. Okay, and so this H here is just the initial preparation state in Grover's algorithm. Again, there's many qubits, so. Okay. And then up here we do the Fourier transform. And And you measure and you get an estimate of the period. Right? So this is just Shor's algorithm again. This part here basically calculates the function. And this part here is just the same as in Shor's algorithm. Okay? And then once we know the period, we can then estimate t. And that tells us, well, we might have to do a little more Grover's algorithm. That tells us how long we have to run Grover's algorithm to get near one of these peaks. Again, we're not going to get it exactly. And since we don't know t exactly, we're not necessarily even going to get all that close. We can no longer do this thing where we can change the phases to make it exact, for instance. But you know, if the probability of getting the marked element, getting a marked element, is above a half, that's good enough, because then, you know, on average, if we do it twice, we'll get a marked element. And once we get a marked element, we can check that, so we know it's really a marked element. Okay? Right. Well, okay. So it's a little bit hidden because I've written everything in terms of big N. But the oracle takes big N possible inputs. Okay. Maybe it's worth writing this down. But if you translate that into an explicit function, right, we would write these big N possible inputs in terms of bits. And so you only really need log N bits to specify the input. And in particular, to specify the marked element. Okay, so the procedure is exponential in kind of the input size, what you think of the input size in this case, which is log n. Okay. So let's see. So it's a speed up over best classical algorithm, but it's still exponential. So that raises the question of, can you do better? Right? I mean, this is some algorithm that does better than classically, but maybe it's not the best quantum algorithm. It turns out, however, that it actually is the best quantum algorithm. So the minimal number of queries in which you can solve this unstructured search problem is omega of square root of n. So omega of something is computer science notation for at least this many up to a constant factor. So it's like the big O notation, but with the inequality the other way. Okay. So if you're saying it requires at least this many, you should use omega. If you say we can solve it in this many, but maybe you could do better, then you use big O. Anyway, the bottom line is Grover's algorithm is, in fact, the best we can do. Okay? Right. So I don't have time to prove it. There's actually, by now, a variety of different proofs. They all are a little bit subtle in various ways. So one way, which if you go to last year's recordings, I kind of quickly sketched it, is you consider a superposition of different possible oracles, and what you'd like to do is you'd like to find out which oracle you actually have, okay, and if you imagine the original oracle was a superposition, then the having the answer, so you have kind of two registers, right? One is the oracle register, and one is your computation register. And so if this computation register knows which oracle register you have, then what you have, you start with a superposition, a tensor product state between the two, but you would end with an entangled state. Right, because now this one knows what's over here. Whereas you started out, you had no idea. So it's just, that was a tensor product. And you can calculate kind of how much, for some particular measure of entanglement, you can calculate how much you can gain every time you query the oracle. And so you say, well, to get kind of full entanglement, you have to query it square root of n times. So that's called an adversary method, a quantum adversary method. But there's other ways of proving it. OK. Are there any other questions? No? OK. So then I'll end there. So that will be it for algorithms, although, of course, you'll be doing the tutorial today and the homework over the next week. And then next week, we'll start on kind of a variety of other topics. We'll do quantum error correcting codes and quantum cryptography, quantum key distribution, and some stuff with entanglement information theory. And we'll see exactly how much time we have. But that will cover it, basically.